Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about median and average student loan debt and why that statistic, both statistics rather, are completely ridiculous and really problematic and cause all kinds of problems when it comes to higher education policy. So if you've ever been told what your average student loan debt for your program is or for your degree or for your field, you're going to love today's episode because you're going to understand why there's lies, there's damn lies, and then there's statistics. So we're going to get into that. But first, folks ask a lot of questions. So we've got a few questions, you know, just with all the volatility we've had in student loan policy the past few weeks that I wanted to go through. So this first question is a question from, it's a two-part question from Bob.
Hi, Travis. I already have a repayment plan. I would like to know if you have a service that I can pay for so that if I have a question about something affecting my plan or some news, I can call up and get some advice over the phone. And can you tell me how the combined average for part-time work for PSLF is calculated? I know you have to work in two jobs, but if it's combined average, is it based on the week, the month, or the year? Thank you.
All right, that's a good question. What I think he's asking is, you know, what do you count for PSLF purposes? You can work two jobs for PSLF part-time, and as long as it sums up to 30 hours a week or more, then you qualify for PSLF if both of the jobs happen to qualify. Now, you can have other non-qualifying jobs, right? If you have three jobs and two of them happen to be not-for-profit or government employers, then those can combine and count. In other words, once you've met that sufficient condition, there's no other kind of limitations or restrictions and other things you can do with your time. So when they're asking, you know, how do you determine 30 hours a week? Well, it's really on an average annual basis, and you have to be employed at the place. So in other words, you can't just sort of say, okay, well, I work 60 hours across two different nonprofit jobs, and I worked there 6 months. So now I'm going to divide that by two so I can get 12 months of credit. No, that's not how it works. You can only get 1 month of credit for 1 month of work. And the question is does this particular month count for PSLF or not? And the way you answer that question is, did the two different jobs that you do, are those 30 hours a week or more? Now, you know, if you have a job that, like, maybe some hours it's less, some hours it's more, as long as overall, like, it works out to an average of 30 hours a week, I think that's what really counts. You know, this is kind of an unusual case to have very wildly fluctuating hours from different nonprofits or government employers. So I would always suggest that, you know, it's just a lot easier to get one job if possible. It's certainly simpler. Although I will say I've seen some people get a very small hourly job just so they can even qualify for PSLF. The second part of the question is, you know, can you pay for a service to call us? We don't have recurring subscription-based services for Student Loan Planner. We have one-time services where you pay a flat fee and you get help. I view that as more consumer friendly. So there are places out there that will charge recurring monthly fees for you to ask questions. That's very profitable for the business, and it's not particularly that good for the consumer, in my opinion. So that's why we have the one-time flat fee, $400 to $600. It's actually $395 to $595, right? And then if you need a follow-up consult, then it's $100 less than that if you need to talk to somebody again. If you have a one-off question, then it's probably better to leave that as a comment on a blog post somewhere if you want a free answer. Even better, ask a question to our podcast that you're listening to, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, and you'll probably get a free response from me. So that would be the way I would suggest getting answers to very short, quick questions. If you want something more in depth, it needs to be studied, right? And that's why we do the follow-up consults that you can do after the initial one. Now we've got a question from Reed.
My question is about refinancing federal student loans. Currently, payments and interest are temporarily paused, private interest rates are relatively low, and there remains a possibility of some amount of COVID-related federal student loan forgiveness. The possible forgiveness amounts commonly discussed are between $10,000 and $50,000. If the plan is to pay off student loans as soon as possible, is it then reasonable to refinance all but up to $50,000 of federal loans to private loans in order to remain eligible for any loan forgiveness? Even if no forgiveness is given, the amount left in the federal loan program could then be aggressively paid off first before moving on to the refinanced loans. Let me know your thoughts, and thank you for your help.
So I get this question actually quite a lot. The thing is they've been talking about canceling student debt so much that everyone's essentially expecting it's going to happen in some form. that's not necessarily the case. I think that if we saw cancellation for everyone, the executive order, that would be stunning to me. The reason is just because you've had the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, come out and say that the president doesn't have the power. So you've got the person who is leading one part of the two chambers of Congress coming out and saying he can't do it. The other person that leads the other chamber, the Senate, Senator Schumer, has come out and said that he should do it. I think it's kind of important to differentiate. This is going to sound kind of weird. I think Senator Schumer is saying cancel student debt, not so much in his role as majority leader, but really in his role as an individual senator. And then I think Speaker Pelosi is coming out and saying this more as Speaker of the House versus Nancy Pelosi, Congresswoman from San Francisco. The reason I say that is Nancy Pelosi, Congresswoman from San Francisco, would probably support canceling $50,000 of student loan debt via executive order. Senator Schumer, you say, well, why does he support it? Well, and by the way, you know, he's the majority leader of the Senate. I just throw these names out there. I assume everyone knows who they are, but I would imagine some people might not. If you think about his situation, he's senator from New York. What's the big risk of someone that's senator from New York politically? Given that he has like the majority leader job nailed down, the big risk would be that he would lose his job to a primary challenge. That just happened to somebody that was pretty powerful in New York that was on a committee for a really long time. And then Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez took his seat in a primary challenge because he was viewed by voters as not being progressive enough. I think that that would be a little bit of a concern from Senator Schumer. And I think that he's cognizant of the fact that the next time he runs, that he could be vulnerable to a primary challenge, particularly somebody who's a majority leader, who is someone who has to be a little bit more moderate than you would maybe otherwise be, being, you know, a senator from a state like New York that's very progressive, right? He kind of has to be a little bit more moderate, perhaps. Compare him, for example, to, I think, Senator, I think Markey is his name, in Massachusetts, who's a very, very progressive senator, certainly much to the left of Senator Schumer. I think that's probably where Senator Schumer would be if he was not involved in leadership. So anyways, I think the student debt cancellation issue is an issue he can kind of come out and say a very progressive position that he knows is probably not going to happen. And then Speaker Pelosi is getting all this pressure from all of these pressure campaigns from the progressive wing to cancel student loan debt. And I think that she's kind of coming out and saying her thought as a Speaker of the House, which is to retain power in the House of Representatives. And the House of Representatives has the power of appropriation first. They are the ones that have to come, all the spending bills have to start in the House. So essentially, that's a power that the House would be losing if the executive branch tried to just cancel student loan debt. And so she came out and said that you can't do that. Sorry if that's a little bit too much political inside baseball or something. But what I think it means is that there's no cancellation coming. You could refinance the whole thing, and I think there's not going to be anything that you're going to be worried about missing out on. That said, if you are very, very concerned, then the most I would do is hold back $10,000 of student debt just in case that amount is canceled for everyone. I still think that's very, very unlikely. I think that's kind of, you know, it's just not going to happen. I should say via the executive branch. Now, via the legislative branch, cancellation could happen because Congress can do anything it wants. I was thinking they might put that in the reconciliation bill, $10,000 of cancellation for everyone, $3.5 trillion bill. You could fit $300 billion of cancellation in that. What they did, though, is they left out student loans completely. So this bill, $3.5 trillion, the latest education and healthcare bill, they are, you know, if they're not going to address it in that bill, they will not address it before the midterms in 2022 when the president's party usually loses seats historically, right? So if it's not going to happen via executive order because the speaker says that they don't have the power, and it's not going to happen via Congress, it's not going to happen at least for the next 4 years. I would say that that's a reason to not leave anything behind personally. But if you wanted to, of course, you could. Now for a question from a physician assistant.
Hi, I am a physician assistant, recent graduate in 2021. I'm set to start my first job here in a couple of weeks, making six-figure salary. However, I do have six figures of student loan debt. Right now, I have about $86,000 in private student loans at an interest rate around 7%. I've been looking into refinancing that, and the interest rate seems to be very good right now, and I can probably get around 3% for 30 years. So I figured that I would really attack that private student loan first and try to destroy that as soon as possible, just throwing any extra money that I have at that loan. I have about $120,000 to $130,000 in debt in federal loans. Those are from graduate school, grad plus loans, so the interest rates are going to be higher on those, at least 7%. So I figured that I would try to, you know, select the repayment plan with the lowest minimum for those federal loans and just kind of pay the minimum on that until I'm done paying off my federal loans aggressively. I'm hesitant to try to refinance any of these federal loans just because of possible cancellation in the future and the 0% interest rate due to the pandemic, you know, continuation of that. Just wondering if you thought that this was a good plan, if there's anything else that I should consider. I know that there's probably many different options and it depends on the person, but, you know, I don't have any kids or anything like that right now, so I can be relatively aggressive towards these student loans. Thank you for your feedback. Much appreciated.
Another one about should we refinance given that cancellation could happen? You can see as I get this question a lot. In this case, the person has private loans and federal loans separately. So they have about 120K federal, about 80 something private. So about 200K total. Now, normally a physician assistant might earn anywhere from like 90 to like 130,000. That's kind of like a normal range for a physician assistant. Certainly some make more than that. And some work at nonprofit hospitals, some work at private practices. Now, regardless though, you know, if I heard somebody had 200K in debt and was making, you know, 90 to 130, I would say, okay, that debt to income ratio is over 1.5 to 1. You probably need to look at doing a pay as you earn type program and going for loan forgiveness. That's probably your best option. The payment in that case would maybe be like $500 a month after saving for retirement. So $500 a month, it's about $6,000 a year. $6,000 a year times 20 years is $120,000. So that's how you kind of can do that math quickly in the back of your head. Okay, you know, about $120,000 of payments. Obviously, that's less than $200,000. The problem in this case is that the person has split up loans, some federal, some private. This is unfortunate because it means that you can only look at the federal loans from looking at your debt to income ratio, and the private loans are just totally irrelevant. Because remember, federal loans, you can only get forgiveness on federal student debt. You can't get forgiveness on private student debt. So if you're looking at $120K debt, and then looking at a, you know, physician assistant income of 100K, let's say, well, that debt to income ratio is close enough to 1 to 1 to say, okay, this is definitely a case where you would want to refinance that and pay it off. The only exception would be if the physician assistant worked at a nonprofit or government employer like a hospital system, because then you can generally make public service loan forgiveness make sense all the way down to like 0.6 debt to income ratio. I mean, you really can play some tricks with the public service loan forgiveness program and make that look a lot better than refinancing in just almost any situation, really. If you have this kind of debt set up, you know, do you do the private first and then do you do the federal later? And what do you do, right? I've already said I don't think cancellation is happening. One way to hedge this in this particular individual's case is you could refinance the 86K private loan to a 20-year term. I think they meant 20-year. There's not really anybody that offers the 30-year term for private student loans that I'm aware of. So you'd pick a 20-year fixed rate at around 3%. So you get a really low payment on that. As a general rule, you can take about 0.6% of the loan amount, and that would be your rough monthly payment. That's just a kind of a real rough rule of thumb. So maybe like $400 or $500 a month would be the payment for those private loans. Then you've got the federal student loans, which are going to be on pause with payments now until end of February is when the first payment will be due. So you'll have to sign up for an income-driven plan, maybe like a revised pay-as-you-earn type of plan. And you could really do one of two things. If you were a student in 2021, that you could consolidate the federal student debt and sign up for the revised pay-as-you-earn, and then you could get a $0 required payment with the 50% interest subsidy even after the end of the COVID interest freeze is up. So you could get, you know, half of your interest subsidized for the first year where those payments are $0 a month based off of the tax return from your prior year tax return showing zero. That would give you the ability to claim a zero income, and that would be good for 12 months. So that would get you some significant subsidies. More realistically, just from an ease of use kind of perspective, I probably refi the private loans right now, and then I would probably wait until you have the end of the federal interest pause in January. And then I would apply sometime around the first part of January, because it's good for 30 days. When you apply, you get an offer. Once you submit everything, it's good for 30 days before it expires. So you could easily apply in the early part of January or mid-January 2022 and then accept the offer or wait a couple weeks to accept the offer so that you accept that offer on the federal student loan refinance kind of right after the interest pause on federal student loans is set to expire. So that's probably what I would do. I'd refinance the private loans now, and I'd be ready to refinance the federal loans sometime in early January. So David now has a question.
Hey, Travis. I'd love to hear your thoughts about what are some realistic possible changes to the PSLF program in the coming years. Obviously, you've talked about things like Kaiser Permanente becoming eligible employers. I'm also interested in what you think the chances are. It could be partial forgiveness, like 5 years, 50% loan forgiveness. I'm just curious what you think could be the future for the PSLF program and any other changes that you see on the horizon that you'd like to discuss. We'd really appreciate your thoughts, and we won't hold you to it.
So thank goodness he's saying I'm not going to be held to it because the thing about student loans is it's always unpredictable. You can never know for sure, but you can operate within zones of probability. So that's what I'm going to do with answering this question is I'm going to say what's more likely than not and what could happen and what do I think is something that I would believe that could happen and what do I think is something that just would never happen. So kind of what I'm thinking with the PSLF program is it seems to me that you're not going to get any massive change legislatively with the PSLF program coming out of this Congress. I think they're focused on other things, you know, with the very chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. You have foreign policy on the mind now. You've got the Delta variant that's been going on, right? There's just so much going on where student loans are like eighth place on the priority list. That's kind of why they paused it for another few months, is partly because they needed to, because of all the chaos changing over from Fed loan and all the fact that they hadn't even put a plan together to help borrowers get into repayment, which is kind of mind-blowing that they just sat around and did nothing until right up to the deadline. And they're like, oh, we're not ready. Now we have to extend it. I'm glad people got an extension, but it's sort of like at least now you know that they're going to have to do the work to get payments started up again. In terms of PSLF, why do I say that? Well, it's because legislatively, something doesn't happen with PSLF is my call for the next, say, 4 years until the next 2024 election. A presidential election, I should say. Since nothing's probably going to happen legislatively, then what I think could happen is things via executive order. And that's actually a real like opportunity for President Biden to make public service loan forgiveness more generous. So recently, President Biden expanded food stamp benefits by boosting them about 25% by just changing some definitions around via an executive order. That's a massive change. I think that you could see stuff like that that would cause PSLF to be a lot more generous. So how would that look? What would that look like? Well, you know, to do a 5-year, 50% loan forgiveness program, they would have to probably come up with a new legislation for that. That's why they came out with the What You Can Do for Your Country Act. That was part of the proposal in that plan, pretty much only by Democratic senators, that said we're going to forgive half your loans for 5 years of service in addition to the normal PSLF program. That would be something that would probably require legislation because it would be spending additional money that Congress hadn't spent yet. What could President Biden maybe have an argument to do via executive order? Well, one, I think, could be the definition of what qualifies for PSLF. Congress talks about a direct loan. Well, a direct loan is a loan owned by the Department of Education. It specifically excludes FFEL loans, which is the Federal Family and Education Loan Program, which existed prior to 2010. That's why you have that bad PSLF headline about nobody qualifying. It's because everybody had those old kind of loans pre-2010, then add 10 years of workforce service, and everybody applying virtually right now would have mostly FFEL loans, which didn't qualify when Congress wrote the rules. Blame Congress. They were the ones that wrote it that way. So my thought is that President Biden can make this argument, hey, FFEL loans, there's two kinds. There's kinds that are owned by banks, guaranteed by the government, and there's kinds that are directly owned by the Department of Education. And we saw that differentiation during the COVID interest pause, where FFEL loans owned by Department of Ed were paused eventually with executive orders, and the ones owned by the banks were not. So I could see that pretty easily happening. I could also see a change in the definition of a qualifying employer. That's already happened, where it used to be that ministers and rabbis, imams, other religious workers were not able to get PSLF because of the definition of them having proselytizing being a core function of their job. And what happened is Congress sort of redid the rules where, not Congress, the Department of Education, Secretary Betsy DeVos, redid the rules so that ministers could be under the qualifying definition of a qualifying employer, right? So that's sort of like a regulation that was changed in the Department of Education via executive action. So I could see something like that happening that would allow an employer like a Kaiser Permanente that is a nonprofit but employs physicians through a for-profit group because of a state-specific law in California that says that you can't employ physicians directly as a nonprofit corporation. I could see them doing some sort of executive action like that and making those loans qualify. So it's not great for Kaiser physicians to sort of be in this limbo. The good news is a lot of Kaiser physicians can qualify for forgiveness in the private sector just via going for pay as you earn over 20 years. So hopefully that would be the case for a lot of the physicians out there waiting around on that kind of an executive action that may or may not happen so that you could keep your loans federal and then kind of not have to worry about it in the sense of, oh man, I'm really running up my interest. I should refinance, but should I not refinance because they might give forgiveness, right? That's the paralysis part. There's similar problems for physicians in Texas, I believe, has another rule kind of like this, where initially I think it was made by state legislatures to prevent hospitals from just getting total control over the physician workforce to give the physicians a little bit of autonomy. So I think initially the medical associations of these states pushed for these rules. And then, you know, obviously nobody really understood how it was going to interact with this random PSLF rule that got passed. So those things are going to get ironed out as more and more people get eligible for forgiveness or see their friends getting forgiveness. And they're going to say, hey, hold up, this isn't fair at all. Like, I'm doing the same kind of job, and yet my friend at UCLA that's a, you know, that's a general surgeon's getting forgiveness, and I'm a general surgeon at Kaiser, and I'm not. And so that's why I think you might see action on that. You know, other things we're going to see is negotiated rulemaking is this huge process where the Biden administration has to ask for tons of public feedback and get expert commentary, and then they make new regulations in terms of how these programs and student loan programs are administered. So that's currently underway. That's a process that's supposed to take about a year, and that means that might take somewhere in the middle of 2022 before that's done. That's not going to be done most likely when student loan payments start up again. So the old program is going to be the way the rules are run when student loans start up again in January of 2022. So then you have their rulemaking process that'll extend into the middle of 2022 where we'll come out with some new rules. And among those new rules could be essentially taking a borrower-friendly sort of approach to adjudicating PSLF. So in other words, they might issue guidance to the servicers, hey, when in doubt, count it for the borrower, right? When a borrower was misled, give them forgiveness anyway, right? You could see some stuff like that, that'll come out. And other kinds of changes would be more specific to the things like borrower defense to repayment, like people that went to defrauded schools, right? I think President Biden's going to try to cancel a lot of student loan debt for a lot of people, but I think he's going to do it within these narrow targeted groups. So if you went to a, you know, for-profit school from this state to this state, you get forgiveness. Let's say, you know, we're in default more than a certain amount of time. Maybe he might try to waive penalties or cancel debt for individuals like that. Maybe people that have had their debt longer than 25 years or something, they might try to cancel it. There's different kinds of executive actions that they might try to take. Now, what will not change? Most likely, you would not see any changes in things like interest rate, existing forgiveness programs. Those things are more outlined, like interest rates, for example, is actually a specific act of Congress that determines what the interest rate has to be. So that's why Speaker Pelosi, when she was talking about what the president's powers around student loan debt are, she said, well, he can delay, right? He can pause, he can delay, but he can't change the programs. So public service loan forgiveness, I think that we're going to see a lot of controversy about this program starting in the 2024 presidential election, because that's when you're going to see a whole lot of higher income people get public service loan forgiveness. And it's going to be a campaign issue, I would predict. And then, you know, by 2028, depending on what the political environment looks like, then you might really see just some really stunningly high bills come due over this program. And then people are going to look at it and think, huh, you know, we're giving most of the forgiveness to physicians and lawyers. Meanwhile, like firefighters and teachers are having a hard time getting their loans forgiven. So we're going to reform the program accordingly. So that's kind of what I would expect in the medium term, just changes, tweaks around the edges to PSLF. In the longer term, I think they'll try to pull it back, rein it in for people that have the higher balances and try to reallocate the benefits towards more lower income people. Remember, if you want to ask a voicemail question, if you want to ask a question about anything in terms of student loan debt or finances or what's going on in the economy, you can ask at studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. So go to studentloanplanner.com, again, /voicemail, and then you can just record on your phone, ask whatever you want. It'll take you 30 seconds, and then makes these shows a lot more interesting. So thanks to everybody who asked a question today, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Now I want to get into the main topic of today's pod, which is really the average student loan debt statistic and the median student loan debt statistic and how they are extremely flawed. I want to highlight this with a personal example, a real-world example that happened in my inbox and on the comments of the Student Loan Planner blog. Basically, what happened is this person just asked a question. We have this article on vet schools. It's called Five Vet Schools, the Five Kind of Vet Schools Ranked by, you know, how much or little they'll screw over your finances. So we talk about for-profit vet schools, private vet schools, out-of-state, in-state, and then the very low-cost in-state schools is kind of the way we structured the article. So anyways, people reach out, people make comments on this kind of thing. And so one of the things that they asked about was this person's like, hey, I'm trying to decide between LSU, Louisiana State University, and Mizzou, University of Missouri. And they're like, I am seeing the numbers that you listed here, and they're like really different from what the school is telling me. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she's like, well, I've been told that it would be $150,000 at University of Missouri. And I thought, well, why would they say that? And I found out that they were saying, well, you know, the average student has about $150,000 of student debt. That's really low cost. You'll come out, you can easily afford to pay that back. And, you know, won't that be great? But the problem with that is you cannot borrow the median and you cannot borrow the average. Okay. So I want to say that again. You cannot borrow the median and you cannot borrow the average. They don't send you a bill for the average student loan debt and say, please pay this. They say, here is the bill for tuition, fees, room and board, and then the student loan folks tack on accrued interest and origination fees. That is a big deal. That's a big difference. So basically what happened is I calculated it for this person. I said I estimated about $350,000 in debt for Mizzou and then about $200,000 at LSU if you're going to be in state. So that therefore I would go to LSU in case you decide you do want to pay back the debt. Then obviously 200 is a lot different than 350 unless you have some sort of extremely important reason why you have to be in Missouri instead of Louisiana, right? Like family, proximity to friends, like if you had some reason why you needed to be in the higher cost of living area, since you can go for loan forgiveness probably in either one of them anyway, you know, you certainly could justify being in either place. But that's what I said. And I got this really angry message from somebody that worked at the school saying, you know, you're giving out misinformation to our students. You know, you're saying that they're going to leave with $300,000 in student loan debt. And this person, the thing that triggered me was this person was like, that's ridiculous. You know, no one that I know leaves with $300,000 of student loan debt from our program. You know, the average debt is only $150,000. And just the other day, we had somebody that talked about how easy it was, and she graduated with only $100,000 in student loan debt. And that, yeah, like I said, it really sort of triggered me. So I was like, all right, let's go to the numbers, because the ultimate defense to slander or libel is the truth, right? If it's true, it's not slander, it's not libel. If you look at the financial aid list of cost of attendance for the school, it lists the out-of-state four-year costs, and this was back in early 2020. It might be a little different now, but it listed all of the combined costs as $351,592. So $350K. Now, I said, now keep in mind, none of the schools ever, and this is true for all schools, they never disclose tuition inflation because they're going to raise your tuition every single year. And you're going to be captive when that happens, and so you won't be able to say no. So they're going to charge you more every single year you're in school. They're also going to tack on loan fees, and for whatever reason, they never accurately list the loan fees correctly. They always list like 1% of the balance. Well, Grad Plus is 4.25 approximately, yet they leave that off a lot of the times. And they also don't include the interest that's going to accrue while you're in school. They just always leave that out because they can't technically calculate it, because the Department of Ed hasn't released the forward-looking interest rate levels, what they're going to charge. And so they just don't include it, right? Because it also makes them look bad. It's kind of like how New York University used to list room and board on their cost of living estimates for schools, or cost of attendance estimates for their dental school, and then they just yanked it off of the site recently in the past couple of years because it made their total cost of attendance look so horrendous. No school is going to want to be the person that goes and lists accrued interest charges on the site, because that would make you look bad compared to your competition. So anyways, I said, okay, if you add on tuition inflation, loan fees, accrued interest. I said my back of the napkin estimate was about $60,000 for accrued interest, about $10,000 for origination fees, and about $20,000 for tuition inflation. So I said, okay, that's about $443,000. And this person, again, was just attacking me for saying that the average statistic that this person was talking about is ridiculous. What I mean is, let's talk about average and median. So until recently, schools were not required to disclose literally anything, like not a single dime of information. They did not have to tell anyone anything, right? It's kind of like these hospitals that just recently were forced to disclose information on the cost of procedures and make that public. And there was this shocking revelation of how much money they were charging for a lot of these procedures. It's the same thing for these schools. They'd never, ever been forced to disclose this information until recently, when they disclosed it in the most ugly looking ream of data, hundreds of thousands of programs or 100,000 programs or something. It was very difficult to read and analyze it. But if you look through the data, you could find the 30, 40 some odd vet schools, for example. And if you look at University of Missouri Vet School, the median debt is about $153,000 and the average debt is about $139,000. So that's from the class of 2016-2017. So how can I say that you're going to leave with $400,000 in debt when, you know, the school is advertising, hey, you're only going to leave here with $150,000? Let me say this. I'm not saying this is what the school is advertising. I'm saying a person at the school that worked at admissions was pushing this really hard that this person's only going to leave with $100,000-something if they're responsible or something. And somebody did make a good point that apparently if you – and after the first year, you can get in-state tuition. So you only pay the really high surcharge for the first year. So then instead of $440,000, if you're in-state, maybe it'd be like $340,000 if you take off the out-of-state fees for those three final years. But regardless, how do you get such a different number? How do you say $150,000 is your average student debt when somebody could leave with $350,000? Because that's a totally different thing, right? If you're telling somebody they're going to come out with $150,000, it's like mind-boggling to come out with more than double that. Here's how that stat works. The schools had to report something, right? So they all have to be backward-looking data. So they're going to go and they're going to report all the data from several years ago. It's already outdated. That's only applicable to people who started vet school in 2013 or 2012. So you're talking about using an average student loan debt stat. The stat is already 10 years old, okay? It's like using the data from the 2010 census now. How do I mean? Well, when that person signed up, they borrowed over 4 years from 2012 to 2016 and graduated. So all of those fees were borrowed at tuition schedules that are 6 to 10 years old. So you cannot go back in time and borrow with those old tuition numbers. They won't let you do that. The school would laugh in your face. You have to pay tuition and fees based off of this fall and after. So if somebody's looking at going to school, first of all, you have to say, well, what is the tuition going to be this fall and then for the next 4 years? So you're borrowing from 2021 to 2025. That's extremely different from 2012 to 2016, right? It's almost a 10-year difference. So that $150,000 average student debt statistic, you'd have to jack that up since tuition is rising like 5 to 7% every year. Depends on the school. Some of them rise faster than that. So you'd have to already jack that $150,000 number up to maybe $200,000 or $225,000 or something just to have apples and apples with the what that statistic would be now. Now we have to ask the question about what is going on with the average and what's going on with the median. So remember, the median was $154,000 precisely, and the average debt was $139,000. So when would the average be less than the median? Usually when you hear some statistic where people talk about average income, and it's like, oh, look, average income is so high. Well, that's because average income includes Jeff Bezos, right? And then that can make your average income look really high, whereas median income, which is the 50th percentile, where half of people earn more, half earn less, that number might be less than the average income. Well, in this case, you would think with all these big, huge balances, okay, $400,000 or something, that average debt statistic would be greater than the median, but it's less than the median. This is the case at a lot of the graduate school programs. Why is this the case? It's because if you take out $1 of student loan debt, you show up in the student loan statistics of a school. So for example, if you take out student debt for 1 year, let's say your parents had saved up enough for 3 years of school and tuition and expenses, but not four. So you borrow for 1 year. You still show up in those statistics of how much people borrowed. Let's say that you borrowed, you got a military scholarship. A lot of the military scholarships might only cover 3 years out of a four-year program. You'll have to borrow for that 1 year to cover the rest of those expenses. That happens all the time in dentistry, where you'll get a three-year scholarship and you have to borrow for that one final year for. Or first year, you know, you might borrow for the first year, for example. So that's like kind of nuts, right? So think about also people that have rich families. A rich family might say something like this: hey, tuition and fees, that's on us, we'll pay that. But you can borrow to cover living expenses. Then that would make a lot of people have small debt amounts that would be included in those stats. Some people are married in school. And a lot of the people that are married in school, what they'll do is they'll borrow for tuition, but they won't borrow for living expenses because their spouse will cash flow that or provide living expenses out of what they're earning. And that also reduces the amount the person borrows. So in other words, the median and average student debt statistic, they are not the median and average student debt statistic for people who had to finance their education. They're the average and median student debt statistic for people that had some help, no help, or a ton of help. You know, it might exclude the people that borrowed zero, but the thing is if you look at people that borrow, there's a lot of people that don't borrow for all the expenses combined that get financial support from other places. And so the person that went to Mizzou Vet School that borrowed $100,000 almost surely had either a scholarship or had some family assistance or had some savings that they used, and that's why they had to borrow less. Whereas this person that's trying to decide what school to go to, they've got to borrow the whole thing. That's how you can make a student debt statistic look way better than it actually is. So for example, one school said that their average graduate paid back their debt in 7 years. That's what they said. The average repayment period is 7 years. Well, the typical person graduated from their school, their dental school, owing $600,000. And if you looked at what you would have to pay a loan back in 7 years on $600,000, you'd have to pay more than 100% of your after-tax earnings. So mathematically, they were full of it. Why would they quote a stat like that? Well, if you go look back in time, the last time they'd pulled statistics and looked at this, people that went to school 10 years ago, right, maybe came out with X amount of dollars of debt. And let's look at what graduates earn now. Okay, well, they earn more than they did 10 years ago, right? So let's say people are earning $150,000 today. So you look at the average debt, which is from 10 years ago, and then you look at the incomes of today, and then you look at those numbers, and you say, oh, people could easily pay this back in 7 years. Or maybe people did pay it back in 7 years a long time ago, but you never update the statistic. It's kind of like my dad, right? Or maybe your parents are kind of like this, where they'll cherry pick a statistic from 1990 and they'll never update it. I mean, it's kind of like my dad, I don't know, like talked about how, oh, you know, South Korea, very polluted place. Well, he hasn't been there since 1980 and he's never updated his statistic to realize that Seoul is like Paris now, or, you know, it's probably a lot cleaner than Paris, honestly, and a lot more beautiful. Maybe my wife would disagree. She probably likes Paris more, right? But, you know, anyways, it's sort of like you kind of think about that, right? Statistics are only good as much as they're updated. And a lot of these average and median student loan debt statistics are hardly updated at all, or if they are updated, they're updated sparingly and not very commonly. That's a huge red flag, huge caution about average student debt and median student debt. You really have to look at what is somebody borrowing that has no financial support whatsoever. That's really the person that you should be thinking about when you're trying to decide how much are you going to owe for a program. Here's another interesting stat. If you look at the American Dental Education Association, ADEA, they publish a lot of data on the average dental school debt. And they compared recently 2015 to 2020. I think it's interesting to look at 2015 and 2020 because you can kind of look at trends over time. Here's a pretty fascinating statistic. In 2015, the percent of graduates with no dental school debt was 14%. In 2020, 5 years later, the percent of graduates with no dental school debt was 20%. If you look at any of the schools, the typical school over those 5 years total cost went up about 20% higher. So how the heck did you have basically 14% of people have no dental school debt, and then 5 years later, even though the average cost of dental school went way up, you now have fewer people that had to borrow? In other words, you have 20, so basically one out of every five dental students didn't have to borrow anything in 2020. and it was maybe 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 that didn't have to borrow anything 5 years earlier. So wait, that doesn't make any sense, right? Think about it. Why would you have fewer people need to borrow with costs of school going up over time? I'll give you the answer. It's because the average student going to dental school is getting richer over time. You look at the really high cost of going, and what is that going to do? It's going to scare away certain people from lower income backgrounds that don't know how complicated loan forgiveness programs work and how complex income-driven repayment programs work. You're either going to look at the cost and say, well, that's ridiculously expensive, but let's say your parent, right, is a wealthy dentist or makes a good income and dentistry was a great career for them. They're like, you know what? I'm just going to bite the bullet and do it because I can, and I'm going to just chip in and help my kid go. So you're going to have a lot of these professions as the costs go up and up and up. You're going to see a wealth effect or wealthification, or I don't know what you'd call it, but basically the typical person going to these schools is getting richer and richer. That's really quite interesting, right? Because if the typical person going is getting richer and richer, you would expect to see increases in amount of support people are receiving from parents. Even if the parents can't fund the whole thing, you're getting a lot of the people that would have to borrow the whole thing that are maybe getting a little scared away from these graduate degree programs. That's another problem with average student loan debt statistics. I mean, if you look at the average student loan debt statistics of these of the American Dental Education Association that they've reported by year. In 2016, the average debt for people that went to private dental schools was $314. The next year, it was $361 for private dental schools. And the year after that, it was $338. It doesn't make any sense, right? $314K from private dental schools in 2016. Now it's $361. Then it's $338. Then it's $296. And then it was back up to 349. It just doesn't make any sense. The number's all over the place. What does that mean? Well, it means their sample size is probably not big enough. And it it probably means that there's a difference in composition of who's responding to these surveys. But you can also tell that the typical person is getting wealthier and wealthier. So it's just kind of all over the place. You really cannot even trust the statistics that you see. Just because it's just really difficult to actually look at that statistic and say, what does that really mean? Now for the granddaddy of them all, the average student loan debt statistic for literally everybody. The data that we looked at most recently was the June 2020 average student loan debt data. And that number was for everyone, for borrowers with federal loans, for everyone, it was $36,520. Again, the problem with that number is there's a whole heck of a lot of people that are borrowing like $5,000. You might say, oh, what are you smoking? No, I mean, like, believe me, that's true. And the reason is you might have one semester that you need a little bit of cash for living expenses. Maybe you got, like in Florida, a lot of people got Bright Futures scholarships that would cover all their tuition, but sometimes people would need a little extra cash for one semester. And so you've got all these people that borrow like $5,000 to $10,000. They talked about canceling debt up $50,000 of student loan debt. They said that would wipe out debt for 95% of people. The average student loan debt statistic for everyone in America, you can say, okay, well, at least we can believe that statistic, right? Because it's all borrowers divided by all debt. Well, think about what that stat really means. Like if you're going to undergrad, your parents' debt is not calculated into your average student loan debt. The Parent Plus Loan Program is under the name of the parent. And so that debt is counted under the parent, which creates another borrower. Well, is it really another borrower? Not really. It's for your education, right? Legally, your parent owes the debt and you don't owe it, but it's still taken out for your education. So if you take the parent's debt and lump it in with yours, that average debt statistic would be higher. If you look at the amount too that people borrow for private student loans are not counted in that statistic either. So that would make the average student loan debt stat higher as well. Then even if you do have the actual correct statistic, you still have to take into account that a lot of people are using funds out of pocket to avoid going into student loan debt, which is keeping that number also lower than what people are going through that had to borrow the whole thing. I say this not to be a negative Nancy or scare anybody or anything. I just want you to know that when somebody says, hey, here's the median student loan debt for our program, or this is the average student loan debt today for dentists, or this is the average student loan debt that people have, or this is the average student loan debt to income ratio for our law school grads. What you would have to say first is say, okay, what are you using for your income number? how recent is the data from. Now tell me your average student debt statistic. What year is that from? Class of what? Class of 2020, class of 2021, class of 2015? And then you'd have to say, well, why would you be comparing incomes of grads now to average student loans debt statistics from people that went to school several years ago? In other words, be skeptical. Don't believe what people tell you when they're talking about average student loan debt stats. And in particular, just have some healthy skepticism whenever somebody sort of tries to justify their educational program based off of what the typical student result is financially in terms of debt. Because the typical student result is not necessarily going to be you unless you're coming from a wealthy family, or unless you have savings, or unless you have spousal support for living expenses. The good news is, even if your average debt is way higher than you thought it was going to be, you can still go for an income-driven payment program. You can do a loan forgiveness strategy. That's what we do, right? That's what Student Loan Planner does. That's why you listen to our pod, is because we try to take all the mess that's out there in terms of the student loan programs and just translate it to what it actually is. So don't let yourself get discouraged. You know, student loan debt is a thing that is way down the priority list in terms of things that will hurt your life. I would say focus on relationships, focus on earning power, focusing on getting your account set up for investing, focus on learning how to invest, focus on not making a really bad decision for what kind of house or what kind of car you buy. And the student loan stuff, you can do all the loopholes in the book and you'll come out with a way lower cost than anybody in the school realizes that you could. And remember, the school is charging you so much money because they know that you can put it on an income-driven plan in the first place, and the schools have no limit into what they can charge you. I hope you take that, and just next time somebody talks about average student loan debt, you just take that number with a grain of salt and you think back to this episode and some of the stuff we talked about how, you know, median, what's the difference between median and average? What is the, you know, what is the data points that are included in this number that calculated the average? Again, just be cautious, right? Because boy, do these programs love to try to throw you for a loop. And a lot of times it's not even intentional. It's just people presenting bad data without thinking about it. So if you need a student loan plan, studentloanplanner.com/help, check us out there. If you need to refinance at today's record low interest rates, definitely check out studentloanplanner.com/refi. And then also if you need to or want to leave us a question or a comment for a pod episode, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Thank you, everybody, and thank you for listening to today's show.